comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Alfredo Rodriguez and Pedrito Martinez on Friday, February 13th at the Nimoy. The Grammy-nominated artists deliver a night of explosive rhythms and world-class musicianship. What begins as a duo of piano, percussion, and voice quickly transforms into a high-octane performance. More information and tickets at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFA 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the surfing, California and beyond.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The ACLU of Minnesota and pro bono partners have filed a class action lawsuit against the Trump administration, accusing immigration agents of racially profiling Somali and Latino residents during enforcement operations in Minneapolis and elsewhere. Catherine Allen Halverson is an ACLU attorney. She said the three plaintiffs were unlawfully detained, one violently taken to the ground, and another pepper sprayed for no reason.
Specifically surrounding Operation Metro Surge, the president has repeatedly denigrated Somali people and said they should go back where they came from. He has repeatedly suggested that they are picking up Somali and Latino criminals, when in reality, they are harassing, stopping, and detaining hardworking Minnesotans in their neighborhoods.
The ACLU is seeking a preliminary injunction to limit agents' actions. The White House is defending its immigration enforcement operations amidst President Donald Trump's threats to invoke the Insurrection Act so he could deploy federal troops to Minneapolis. Lauren Schmidt reports.
DHS Secretary Kristi Noem was questioned by reporters.
Every single action that our ICE officers take is according to the law and following protocols that we have used for years.
Why is it within their right to ask for papers without reasonable suspicion?
The latter question went unanswered. But Noem claimed that officers have adequate training, despite an explosive report by NBC News that alleges an artificial intelligence error allowed many recently recruited ICE officers to be sent straight into field offices without proper training. But the tone quickly shifted to lightheartedness when asked about the Insurrection Act and canceling midterm elections. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
The president was simply joking.
I'm Lauren Schmidt.
An immigrant detainee's death was likely a murder, according to preliminary reports from the El Paso County Medical Examiner's Office. This pending a toxicology report, first reported by the Washington Post. Geraldo Lunas Campos' death was declared 2 weeks ago with no stated cause. Another detainee said he witnessed multiple guards on top of Campos and at least one of them choking him. The preliminary death is asphyxia due to neck and chest compression. Also in Texas, an ICE prosecutor is back at his job despite a media outlet, the Texas Observer, exposing James Roden for running a white supremacist X account praising Hitler and calling America a white nation. Roden was pulled from court schedules and Congress demanded an investigation last year. ICE is now refusing to comment to the publication. In Gaza, a committee held its first meeting as part of the Board of Peace, part of President Donald Trump's peace plan to end the war between Israel and Hamas. It occurred after Israeli strikes killed two people in Gaza, including a child. The Israeli publication Haaretz is reporting Hamas said it's ready to hand over its responsibilities to a Palestinian technocratic committee set to administer Gaza on an interim basis, and is welcoming U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff's announcement a transition into phase two of President Trump's peace plan is underway. A cleric leading prayers in Iran's capital has demanded the death penalty for detained protesters. Iran's crackdown was a topic of a U.N. Security Council meeting Thursday. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump has repeatedly threatened to intervene militarily in Iran, and U.S. Ambassador Michael Waltz told the council all options are on the table to stop the slaughter.
Unarmed, peaceful people who love their country are taking to the streets in pursuit of their legitimate aspirations for a better future. Well, this is our message. President Donald J. Trump and the United States of America stands by the brave people of Iran.
Iranian journalist and political dissident Masih Ali Alinejad.
I now address the representative of the Islamic Republic directly. You have tried to kill me three times.
Iran's permanent representative to the UN, Amir Sayed Iravani, denied killings of peaceful protesters. He says the United States and its allies cannot evade responsibility for shedding innocent blood in Iran. I'm Christopher Martinez.
And President Donald Trump got his sought-after Nobel Peace Prize. Venezuelan opposition leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Maria Machado said she gave Trump her medal. That does not make him a Nobel Peace Prize winner. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You're listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpty. Today on Sojourner Truth, we speak with my sister, comrade Kat Brooks, about reclaiming Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy and the lessons we clearly need to pick up and move with today, followed by Mildred Pierre, a fierce comrade who will share about her fight to keep her fiance, Rodney Taylor, in the U.S. with their family and community. All this and more on Sojourner Truth Radio after this short music break. Happy birthday to ya, Stevie Wonder. Happy birthday, dedicated to Creative for not us at our birthday party, though we can use it, but for the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday was yesterday, the 15th, and whose birthday we are celebrating this weekend. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with me, your host, Nana Jumpty. And we celebrate this birthday, celebrating his prophetic voice, his dedication to human dignity, and his commitment to a world in which every single person and the planet can flourish. I'm so glad to be joined by my sister and my comrade, Kat Brooks to talk about the legacy of Dr. King and why we must reclaim it. Kat Brooks is an organizer and an artivist. She is the executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project, also the host of Law and Disorder on KPFA and KPFK weekday mornings at 8 a.m. Welcome, Kat. Thank you so much for coming on.
What's happening, sis? Thank you so much for asking me. It's been a minute since it's been this way.
I'm telling you. And after I heard that headline news, I just threw all the questions I have to the side. Like, my God, if there was a time to reclaim the legacy of FBI.
Baby.
Because we know that it has been so twisted, right? The way in which Dr. King is talked about, the way in which Dr. King is taught about, the way in which Dr. King is presented, and, you know, and it's made so anemic and sometimes even weaponized against the very people for whom he fought, you know, for and alongside. And so I'm really glad to have you on to talk about this today, because we know I'm getting ready. I'm, you know, we're going to see what DHS and the White House and all of them are going to do this weekend in their maybe effort to so-called celebrate King. But before we get into this, please talk to us about the Anti-Terror Police Project, or Anti-Police Terror Project, because I don't want to lose that. And I want to be able to fold that into our conversation.
Sure. So the Anti-Police Terror Project, just say APTP, it's easier. It's the worst name ever for a communications professional. You'd have thought I'd do better. It sounds like a virus sometimes, but nobody ever gets it right. But the dish is between police and terror. And we were formed 15 years ago. Well, longer than that. Oscar Grant was murdered in 2009. We were born out of the fight for Oscar Grant in 2010. And really in the midst of rolling protests that lasted for about 5 years, where thousands of folks were in the street at least once a month. And we asked the question, though, right? Like, okay, it's great. We're mobilizing all these people. And it's a question that can and should be asked right now. We're mobilizing all these people into the streets nonstop, but the state just keeps killing us, right? And so what are we as organizers actually doing? One of my comrades, Asantewaa Boykin, who's a co-founder of APTP, said at the time she felt like, and I won't say his name, but a civil rights attorney who handles a lot of these cases, she says, I feel like him, like we're just chasing dead Black bodies. And so at that point, we asked ourselves several questions. Why do we just accept that if you're Black in this country, it means that the likely, you know, you just have to deal with the police murdering you or your loved ones? What happens to the families? What does it look like to stop state violence before it happens in the first place? And so APTP was born out of trying to answer those questions. And our mission is to eradicate state terror in communities of color. That's our work.
Thank you. And so very much. And the work is, you know, when you say that's a work, it's a lot of work that has been done, not only in the pushback part in terms of trying to make sure that you stand in the gap and stand in the way when it comes to violence in our communities, but also the build part, building community, building institutions, putting things together that we need in order to address both police terror, but also to address just the what we need and deserve in this world. Connect that for me to this Reclaim MLK. We know that there's Reclaim MLK events that are happening in Oakland. They're also happening all across the country. But when you all are talking about Reclaim MLK in Oakland, what is who's the MLK you're trying to reclaim? Let's start with that.
Right. Well, actually, what I got to do is I got to live in the principle I ask other people to stand in, and that's I got to pay homage to the people or the person that put out this call initially. So it was put out 12 years ago by a national formation. There were a lot of them at the time. There was BLM, there was BYP 100, and I can't remember exactly the one, but the person was Maurice Mitchell, who is now with Working Families Party. The call came from him. And what it asked for was a day across the country to reclaim the radical legacy of King. King, the freedom fighter, King, the revolutionary, King, the direct action practitioner, King, who put his body on the line for Black liberation, King, who stood in the face of power and said, absolutely not, that King, the King that took radical action in the face of irrational circumstances. And so the call was for a day. We're Oakland, so what we first did was 96 hours. That then went up to a week. And now I got younger folks in the organization. So now I think we're at 2.5 weeks or something bananas like that. But it's a series of teach-ins, film screenings, sometimes direct action, the shutdowns, marches, protests. It's a time, you know, we've got a concert. It's a time to come together and have conversations about what it means to be radical. And in the demand, which it isn't a radical demand, but to be radical in our demand of the assertion of our humanity. And so that's what we'd be doing when we reclaim his legacy. And not the whitewashed version you get in the 2 paragraphs of the history books in the American school system, right? Not the one that had a dream. We remember the king who said loudly that his dream had become a nightmare.
And also said loudly that we must fight these triple evils of racism, capitalism, which he described in the context of fighting against poverty, and militarism. And I'm telling you, of course, we already knew this. We already know this. This is the work we do. But hearing those news headlines, there was not a headline that did not deal with racism, capitalism, militarism in some form or fashion. Let's talk about a couple of things that came up that are happening right now that the headlines also discussed and thinking about King's legacy. One of them, and I'll start sort of in reverse order, is war and what we're seeing happening, in Venezuela, hearing about what the intentions are with respect to Iran. And people should take that seriously because, they should think about the bombing of Nigeria and how that was supposedly to help the Christians in Nigeria. And they did. They didn't help the Christians, but they sure did bomb. And so people should not take that lightly. Eyeing of Cuba, eyeing of Greenland. What would King be saying now based upon what we know of the radical King?
I actually think he'd be saying some 21st century version of what he said in his 1968 Beyond Vietnam speech, right? That America is the greatest purveyor of evil in the world. Now, he'd throw Israel in there around this time for sure. But as I was listening to the headlines, and actually, Nana, when you were asking the question or alluding to the question that you were going to ask, giving a nod to the headlines, and I was thinking about how insane the world feels to us right now, with the very violent assertion of white supremacy to rule the world by enemies necessary, that it's just a 21st century version of the 20th century that King was living in, right? Where colonial powers were divvying up countries, where the United States and other world powers were in active colonization and ruling of countries that did not belong to them, where killing black people on the street because a white person said they looked at them wrong went without punishment, where white vigilantes had their way with black bodies, where the United States government did what it wanted to do, where there was a war, where we were saying that we were there for freedom, but really we were there for land and political gain. So as bad and as horrible and awful as things are right now, I just had this aha, and feel free to push back at me about it. I'm just like, well, this must have been what King felt like when he woke up every day and read the headlines. Now, the news hit him a little slower because he didn't have the internet. But the insanity then is the insanity now. It's just with the 21st century spin on white supremacy with a madman in the White House.
No, I would agree. I would say that there is some evolution that has occurred because we're not using those phones that go, they just spin. We're not using the spinning phone anymore, right? And so as you rightly point out, the technology makes it different. So I want to talk about surveillance in just a brief moment. But even when we're thinking about the issues with respect to poverty, right, and capitalism. And yes, I mean, it's not maybe there weren't as many billionaires, but whatever it was in the 20th century, which I'm chuckling when you say that because I was alive, baby.
But when I wasn't. I mean, I was alive in the 20th century, but I wasn't alive when King was alive.
Okay, no, me neither. But when the 20th, when you think about They didn't have the same degree, right, of wealth that had been accumulated at that time. Maybe if we looked at the comparison, it would come out to be similar. But still, you know, so it's like, what is happening now? The way in which people can make money due to just automation, just the introduction of automation, the fact that you don't got to pay a bunch of people, the fact that you have almost less unionized space now than you did at that time. To some degree, right? I think that it is the same, but I think that the technology and the impact of tech on even this vast difference in wealth, you know, the wealth gap, I think makes it so that it feels so much more like a broligarchy now than maybe what it may have felt to King. But what do you think?
For sure. I mean, I think that were he with us, right, he would feel the increase in the rapidness with which violence and white supremacy and false information moves. I think even that is an evolution, the blatancy of lies, the twisting of the truth, the gaslighting that happens can happen in a very different way, right? So we can watch Renee Good be murdered from 8,000 different angles from cell phones, and then at the same time watch the devil, Kristi Noem, tell us that that's not actually what we're seeing. And I think that that creates a different kind of cognitive dissonance that we're also wrestling with. And we're also wrestling with the social media, the internet, right? We're wrestling with where people not only are getting this rapidness of information, but there's no vetting of that information. Like, anybody can say anything, and it can go out to, there's an idiot declaring himself the new chair of the Black Panther Party, and there's thousands and thousands of people that are following him. So that kind of thing could happen in real time and really impact our the political fabric of our country. But I think what's important here actually to pull out is that while we are uplifting the radical legacy of King and the radical ways in which he resisted, somebody asked in an event that I had earlier this week, like, well, what are the organizing strategies now if they're not the same ones that they used then? The organizing strategies now have to reflect the realities of now, right? So putting your body on the line is still a thing we have to do, but it looks different than what it looked like for King as he was marching in the streets. There are different precautions that we have to take right now. We have to assume, you said you wanted to segue to surveillance, maybe this helps
us get there.
We have to pivot. We have to assume that everything, I don't care if you use Signal, we have to assume that every single thing we say, type, perhaps think, right, that they know about already. And how do we account for that and protect ourselves while continuing to resist, because stopping resisting is not an option.
Absolutely. And, the reason the surveillance also came to my mind as I think about Dr. King, and I want to go back, of course, to talking about what folks can be doing to plug in to make sure that we're uplifting and even engaging in terms of that reclaim of Dr. King. Part of what made me think about it is because I know his family has been fighting to keep this particular regime from putting out early the FBI files on King, because the regime knows that they gonna have some janky stuff, right, that they have recorded, and they are chomping at the bit to be able to play those recordings for all of us in their effort to smear and besmirch Dr. King even more. And so thinking about, you know, the surveillance is no longer that tape recorder under the bed, right? That this is something that is everywhere, that is in all places and at all times. And we have to think about that as we're organizing and moving in this time period, as you pointed out. Let me ask about what people can do now. So I'd like to get some specifics in terms of, like, I know there's a rally and a march coming up on Monday that people can participate in Oakland. But then what are things that people can do who are listening to this now and feeling like, you know what, I want to commit myself to moving in this legacy of the radical King?
The thing that I will say, the most important thing that you can do in this moment is find a vetted, rooted organization with actual organizers that can take you under their wing and teach you the craft of organizing, that has a structure, that has elders, that has people that you can be accountable to, that has a stated and proven track record of actual politics, that stay steeped in political education and move with them. That is the most singular important thing that you can do in this moment. You do not have to reinvent the wheel. You do not, I say all the time, I mean, if you really and truly, you can't, I'm talking to the Bay right now, but I guess I can say LA too, because you all got the same complex we have. If you cannot, in the entire state of California, out of the 9,462,005 nonprofit organizations and grassroots and cadre organizations that exist, find one that speaks to your heart, I guess start your own. But that's actually the problem we have right now. That's actually why we have a dearth of organizers, because the 2020 explosion of people in the streets met COVID and a lot of us were inside. And so now we have a bunch of people running around calling themselves organizers that couldn't put together a campaign plan if it bit them in the backside. We need strategy right now. We need political acumen right now. We need tactics right now. We need to folks that can help you discern what happened in the past, what worked, what did not, what makes sense right now, and what does not, right? We need the veterans. You need to be sitting at the feet of veterans, and we need to be moving in formation. That is the most important thing I think that can happen right now. We need to be training an army of organizers. Reaction is fine. And a lot of stuff that's happening right now is reaction. That is important because it keeps it in the headlines. It keeps people engaged. It's the initial on-ramp for folks in a movement work. But movement work that is just rooted in reactionary emotion is not movement work. It does not change material conditions, and it is not sustainable. And we have to be thinking about not just how we're going to resist, hold on, deal with this particular time period. We need to be thinking about what strategies are we putting in place, what formations, coalitions, agreements are we putting in place that is going to get us not just through to the other side, but to be on the winning side, right? When we get there, and for the material conditions of our people to look dramatically different so we are never back here again. That is the assignment.
Absolutely. And I would, someone had said something to me yesterday about knowing the difference between reacting and responding. Oof. Right. Because, yes, we do need, I mean, I do capoeira on goal, as you know. Of course, if you are doing something towards me, I need to defend myself, right? And then I need to go on the offense. And my whole game can't be defense, whole game can't be offense either, right? But if I just react, if someone throws a punch at you or throws a kick at you and you just react, I guarantee you, you're going to get that femur broken. Feel me? Because you're just going to put something out there that's not actually ready to get hit.
Exactly.
But if you respond, there's an intention in there, as you've talked about. There's a training in there. There's, you know, there may be some muscle memory in there, but it's the memory that comes out of practice.
That's right.
And I think that it's so critical that we recognize that when we see and when you read and the Radical King, when you hear the Radical King's words, when you see the actions of the Radical King, then these are not reactionary, that these are strategic, that they're tactical, that they are responses, right? And that there's some effort to look and see, you know, to sit back, to do, and then to say, hey, how did that work? And to be able to be radically honest with yourself about whether we're being effective or not being effective.
Ooh,
I think all of that is important.
Preach. Yep, it's critical. Critique, self-critique. You want to know somebody's good at being an organizer? When they can come to you and say, yo, I was wrong here. Let's all sit down together and retool, right? That's someone you can think about following.
Absolutely. If folks want to learn more about Reclaim MLK in Oakland, where do they go? How do they do that?
You can follow Anti-Police Terror Project on all the socials, but I would focus on the Insta. My guy, Lance Wilson, our comms guru, he loves the Insta. So that's where we be. That's where all the information is. And actually, if you really want to know about the legacy of this, I Googled Reclaim MLK 2015, which was the first year, the other day. And the most amazing headlines, thought pieces, reporting on actions, talking to different movement folks of the time. It was really fascinating to see where our movement was and where it's come on this particular strategy each year.
Well, shout out to Mo and shout out to Movement for Black Lives. Shout out to all the folks who have put in so much work and thought, and since then, so much effort, work, and thought so that we can still be reclaiming MLK today. Thank you so very much. We will catch you next week at 8 a.m. on KPFK, KPFA.
Right on, sister. Right. I appreciate you. Be safe. Breath and water.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Folks, that was my sister and comrade, Kat Brooks, executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project, also known as APTP. So glad to be able to speak with her about reclaiming Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. More Sojourner Truth Radio with Mildred Pierre after this station break.
Invited to join Maggie LaPique for a special live edition of Profiles on Saturday, January 17th at 9 a.m. Maggie's special guest Saturday will be four-time Grammy Award winner Stanley Clarke, one of the most celebrated acoustic and electric bass players in the world. He's equally gifted as a recording artist, performer, composer, conductor, arranger, producer, and film score composer. Stanley will be discussing his forthcoming release, Last Train to Sanity, and his run of engagement at the Blue Note LA, January 22nd through the 25th in Hollywood. That's Stanley Clarke Live, this Saturday, January 17th at 9 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. And you can listen online at kpfk.org.
This is Saul Williams, and I'm a proud supporter of KPFK because it supports our community.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say I'm loud, say I'm clear for the whole round world to hear.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Very, very glad to turn now to Mildred Pierre, who speaks loudly, helping us all to be free. A powerful community health advocate and strategist. She blends lived experience, policy insight, and grassroots organizing to fight for justice, equity, and humane treatment. As the co-founder of Community Spark Solutions, she consistently leads with courage, compassion, and precision, driving impact across health equity, immigration advocacy, and community empowerment. Mildred is also the fiance and fierce advocate for Rodney Taylor, a beloved husband, father, son, brother, family, and community member who has been detained by ICE for almost a year now. Thank you for joining me, Mildred.
Oh, thank you so much, Nana, for having me. I appreciate this spotlight. I appreciate this space. Thank you.
I keep making you married. I keep calling the man your husband. I know he's your fiance, but forgive me because I will be at that wedding. Forgive me.
No, you all right. We're legally married now. You all right.
All right. Let's start talking about Rodney. Talking about Rodney Taylor, who again has been in the Stewart detention. They call it a detention center, but really it's a detention prison, and it's been there for almost a year now. Right. Some people have heard of him and heard of what happened with him. Some people have not. I'm going to help us to walk through it a little bit. But firstly, Rodney Taylor was not born in the United States. He was born outside the United States. Tell us a little bit about his, you know, early life. Give folks a sense of who we're talking about here.
Yeah, thank you. Rodney was born in Liberia, West Africa. He came to the United States at the age of 2 for medical treatment. Rodney is a double amputee. Rodney was born with several different medical difficulties, including a cub foot, a missing foot on each leg. And Rodney walked for the first time at the age of 3 with the use of prosthetics. Rodney is a funny guy. He's a master barber. He picked up training at the age of 14, 15 years old by the hand of his aunt. She believed, disability or not, there's nothing you can't do. So she enrolled him in cosmetology school. It was a high school program at the time in Indianapolis. And so he got his training there and his education there. Rodney is a community leader. Rodney used the skills and the talent that he learned to share with the community around him. Rodney provides provide free haircuts to underserved communities in our area. Underserved, especially to mothers or single mothers with multiple children. He is big on health advocacy. Rodney pushed a lung cancer campaign in our county to get Black people to learn about lung cancer and to get a lung cancer screening. He also put on a free health fair. He planned it. Unfortunately, he was never able to see it, but we were able to push that for him. He provided a free health fair in the plaza of the barbershop where he worked, and he provided free haircuts, free health services, free resources, and served over 150 people at that health fair. Rodney is a good guy.
And this good guy who is, you know, part of you all are family, you have children, and it was, as so many of our folks in our community, our neighbors, our family members are experiencing, snatched by the body snatchers, ICE and them, about a year ago. Talk to us about that. What actually happened?
So we were getting the kids ready for schools early in the morning, like 8 o'clock, and putting the kids in a car. And at the corner of my eye, I see a car parked in the cul-de-sac. And usually cars don't park there. So it caught my attention immediately. But I didn't think nothing of it. But interestingly enough, the day before, there was a gentleman looking at a car parked in front of my house. And he had a gun on his hip. He was not a police officer. He was in a regular car. He was asking me questions about one of my vehicles. And I asked, well, are you the police? Why are you asking me all these questions? And he said, well, I'm looking for someone. I'm looking for someone named Rodney Taylor. I'm like, why are you looking for Rodney Taylor? Oh, because he was driving this vehicle, and this vehicle was in a car accident. And I'm like, okay, sir, clearly this car was not in a car accident. What are you really here for? Oh, no, I just was curious because we're looking for the vehicle. And he was like, so does Rodney Taylor live here? And I was like, maybe, maybe not. Like, why are you asking all these questions? Nonetheless, the gentleman said he had to hurry up and he had to leave. He had to pick up a call or something like that. He jumps in his vehicle and he leaves. And the next morning, again, I'm parked in front of the car. I'm parked in my driveway. I look to my right. I see a car in the cul-de-sac. Didn't think nothing of it. So we get in the car. Me, Rodney, and the two kids, 4 and 6 at the time, our daughters get in the car. We pull out the driveway, and immediately, like 2 houses down, not even, there's 2 cars that blocks me in front. So like a head on, like they're going to come on and hit me head on. And then a 3rd car that kind of pins my door, like kind of like blocks me from opening the door. And then the car I look in my rearview mirror. That car that I saw in the cul-de-sac is now behind me, pinned me from behind. So I can't move forward. I can't move backwards. And now it's about 10 men outside of the car. Rodney Taylor, Rodney Taylor. We're here to arrest Rodney Taylor. And we're like, what is going on? None of these people are marked. The cars aren't marked. The clothing aren't marked. They're wearing bulletproof vests. They're wearing brown and black. And I am scared because I don't know who these people are. It was like a scene from a movie. And some of them have their hands on their gun. Some of them have their guns drawn out. And we were scared. My kids in the back crying. And Rodney looking at me like, what's going on? I'm like, I don't know. Why are they calling your name? How do they know your name? And an agent came to the car and like basically opened the door. Basically helped Rodney out the car. And they put handcuffs on him. And Rodney's like, where are you guys taking me? Who are you guys? What's going on? And they're like, well, we're ICE. And Rodney was like, ICE. And I'm looking at him like, what's that? And he's like, well, you know, my immigration. I'm like, well, what's going on? Like, your immigration, you know, we got things rolling. You shouldn't be getting arrested. And I asked the gentleman, where are you taking him? Because they didn't provide me any documents. So there was no warrant. They didn't give me anything, no documents, no warrant. And so I had no information to go on. So I'm like, where are you guys taking him? ICE, Atlanta. I'm like, well, where is that? The gentleman told me to Google it. So I did. I Googled it. And so at that moment, I'm like, I'm freaking out. I don't know what to do. I'm like, what? Who do I call? How do I know this is ICE for real? How do I follow these people? Like, how I know where they're taking me is true. And from there, I'm in my car. And Rodney's like, I need my blood pressure medication. Can I get my blood pressure medication? One of the agents was like, well, you can't get it, but she can. He's pointing at me. And so he comes with me, allows me to go back home, get the blood pressure medication, write Rodney's name on it, put in a Ziploc bag and give it to the agent. By the time I come back outside, they're gone with Rodney. And now it's only one car. We went from five cars to now one car. And that was the morning. That was January 15 of last year. It was a beautiful, horrific, horrible day. That was how he was detained.
Thank you for sharing that. And I know that it's not easy to share that because we relive these things when we describe them out. But I think it's important for people to understand how these things are happening, and particularly that they are happening also to Black folks, right? Because a lot of what we see in terms of images across our social media posts are made, you know, usually not when we're talking about people being dragged away, are not Black people. So we see a lot of Black people being approached and, you know, asked about their citizenship and, you know, maybe arguing, particularly recently. We're seeing a lot of that. Some of them real. Some of them, by the way, folks are AI, are not real. Okay. But some of them real. But, you know, not really getting the opportunity to hear from family members of Black immigrants that actually have been detained, right, are in prison right now in ICE detention prison. I think it's important. The conditions we often talk about on this show, the way that conditions for Black immigrants are disproportionately worse than they are for immigrants of other races in detention. And then we know with Rodney's health conditions and with his disability that it's even more so. And he's really had to struggle just to get folks, these people, to even help him with his prosthetics. Talk about that, please, because I think it's important for people to know what folks are going through so they can understand how all, you know, I think it's what, last year, 30 people died in ICE custody. Right. Not being shot. We're talking about dying in detention prisons and detention jails. So I think people need to, it's good for people to hear what conditions are, even for people with health conditions and disability.
Thank you. So to give people an understanding of what Rodney looks like and what he faces, Rodney walked for the first time at the age of 3. He has been wearing prosthetics since 3 years old. He became a double amputee at the age of 10. He is now 47 years old. ICE detention is horrific. It is not meant for human space. It is not meant to hold humans, to be honest. It's meant for animals. And then to have a disability on top of that, it just make it that much more worse. Let's start with the food. The food is disgusting. It's without taste. And when it does have taste, it's full of salt. So if you have other health issues like diabetes or high blood pressure or other health conditions, it's not conducive to your pre-existing health condition. There's not enough space. You have detainees sleeping on the floor on cots. You have a mold, black mold growing on the floor. You have sometimes the ceiling is wet. You have water dripping from the ceiling and it's getting on the ground. You have the showers. If you can imagine, Rodney doesn't have any feet. Put that in your mind, no feet. So to take a shower, you have to remove the prosthetics and crawl to take a shower. Well, where he crawls to take a shower is full of mold, feces, human bodily fluids, and it's full of mold, blue and green colors, as he explains. He said it's disgusting. He says last night he actually he put a sock in the faucet of where in the faucet restroom area or bath. I don't know how to explain it, but it's a faucet in his room, and it was making a lot of noise. So he put a white sock inside the faucet so it could stop making noise so he could sleep. He pulled out the faucet today, and the socket was black. The faucet was black. The sock where the socket was black. So you can imagine the water that these detainees, women are drinking is not clean. He says when he drinks the water, it makes his throat hurt. And so we have to, make sure he has money in commissary to purchase water. The water is not drinkable. These are some of the conditions that he's facing in detainment. During the summer, the air conditioning was not working for 2 months. In hot Atlanta, can you imagine being in a hot box with no access to a window, no fresh air, and it was hot for 2 months? And with his prosthetics, he cannot be in a hot environment. Otherwise, it will malfunction. So his prosthetics has a microchip, it's high tech, and it cannot be in extreme weather. It can't be too cold, it can't be too hot. Otherwise, these prosthetics will malfunction because it's basically a computer. Can you imagine leaving your computer outside in 120 degree weather, or leaving outside in minus degree weather? It's the same thing with prosthetics. And so there was a one time where it was very hot. It was the detainment center AC was not working and the ground was wet. And they didn't take Rodney to charge his prosthetics since it's required to electricity charging for him to be able to walk. And they told him, get up. You have to, we're doing count. And Rodney was like, well, I can't get up. One, it's too hot. Two, the ground is wet. I could slip and fall. Three, you guys didn't take me to charge my legs. Well, from there, they took him to solitary confinement because they said he was not, he was acting disorderly or he was not, responding to commands. But in fact, they didn't give him an opportunity to charge his legs. So he really couldn't walk, but the ground was wet. So he was scared he was going to fall. And so they took him to call him solitary confinement. He was there for 2.5 days, where solitary confinement was worse. The conditions there was worse than where he is right now.
Let me interrupt you briefly.
Yeah.
Because I think, and thank you for that description of what the conditions are, just the conditions for everyone, and then also the conditions for Rodney with his disability, what you've just shared, actually being put into the hole, which is what solitary confinement is, which, by the way, Black migrants are 6 times more likely to be put in solitary confinement than migrants of other races. And so for him to be put into the hole because he can't move, when the reason he can't move is because of them, and they know what it is. Like they know what his condition is. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mildred, but they keep saying that they have the capacity at Stewart Detention Prison to properly take care of Rodney, but that doesn't seem to be happening.
Right. They keep saying they have the capacity, but that's absolutely not true. They do not have, they don't merely have the equipment to even calibrate his prosthetics. They don't have the equipment to make sure that his liners for the prosthetics are provided. They don't have the capacity to make sure his other medical conditions are served. And yet they keep saying, yes, we do. We could support him. We can hold him. One of the wardens, there's a new warden. The warden, you know, was like, why are you here? You should be in a medical facility. We honestly can't support you. I don't know why you're here.
Yeah, but yet they're not letting him out.
Honestly, had a cancer.
Right, yet, but they're still not letting him out.
Right, and they're still not
so letting him out. What, I know there's things that you have been doing and working with community and family to get him out, right? To lift up this case, to lift up the situation of Rodney. And of course, by doing so, lift up the situation of others that are being held in Stewart Detention Prison as well. You know, so we've got the legal piece that's happening. He has his case that he's fighting in order to not be deported. He has a habeas that he's filed in order to be released while that underlying immigration case is happening. But in terms of the community piece in the short time that we have here, if you could please describe, you know, just take a couple of minutes. What have you and community done to try to get Rodney out?
First, I'd like to thank Black Alliance Just Immigrant. Baji has been instrumental in making sure Rodney gets this habeas filed and petition submitted. Thank you. Thank you. We have done rallies. We've done petitions. We have done what's called social media campaigns. We have gone to Washington D.C. and spoke to congressional hearings at a congressional hearing. Rather, we have partnered with other organizations to knock on, you know, ICE door and to knock on elected official doors to hear Rodney's story. We have been boots on the ground trying to get this story out to anybody that will listen. We have spoken to reporters. We have spoken to news outlets. There's many different things we've done, yet we are still here. We're looking to put a campaign together for 2026 to change the game for Rodney, to change the game for other disabled detainees that are in the same situation with him. Those are some of the things we've done already.
And if folks want to plug into any of those things, what should they be doing? Is there like a GoFundMe or any other way that people can be of support?
Yes. So we do have a GoFundMe. It's if you go on Instagram, Free Rodney Taylor, if you put that in the search box, the GoFundMe link is on that page. We would truly, truly deeply appreciate your financial support, your prayers. We also have a signed petition. Also, if you can sign that petition also, that would be wonderful. It's immigration law is not cheap, let me tell you. And we have come a long way and to support Rodney's medical needs and his other services. That GoFundMe goes a long way, and we would deeply appreciate the community support.
And then I know that, you know, like me, you are a Black person who was born in this country of parents who were not born in this country. And so this for us is personal, right? Beyond Rodney, we have folks in our own communities that are really looking at harsh times right now and ahead. You look at Haitians and how you have 300,000 Haitians that are about to lose TPS in February. We see what's happening with all of the travel bans, with this increased focus, particularly as they're looking at Somali folks. It's not just Somali folks, right? It's like an increased focus on Black immigrants generally. What are you seeing more people who are willing to speak up? Are you seeing more people who are in need of support as we've gone through this past year from where you started, which is basically when this regime came to power, to now?
Absolutely. More so now than before. And that has everything to do with the ICE ramping up more, you know, arresting more people. I met a Haitian family that's trying to support their, you know, loved one that's housed in the same detainment center as Rodney. I've seen a Jamaican family. The Jamaican family, he's American. He's a Army veteran. He's in detainment right now in the same detention center as Rodney. It's at the beginning of this campaign for Rodney, trying to get people to know what's going on. It was, it's not me. Oh, I have a green card. I'm protected. Oh, I'm this, on that. This does not apply to me. I'm a citizen. And as we can see today, right? You know, you don't have to be a citizen. You don't have to be Black. You could be white. You could still get killed. It doesn't matter. Anybody's getting picked up right now by ICE. And now the sympathy is like, oh, now I understand. It took for, you know, a few people to die that look like me, or may not look like me, rather, that is a U.S. citizen, for us to understand, hey, I could be this person. I could be a detainee. I could be picked up by ICE any moment. So the change has shifted. I mean, if you look back a year ago today to what it is now, people are a lot more conscious. I want to say people are a lot more sympathetic, a lot more woke, right? Or scared. That's the right word.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. We see more of that. People are definitely, I mean, when even the polls are showing that the attitude that people have about ICE in particular right now, even though we know that it's not just ICE out there, folks. That's why I call them the body snatchers, because it's ICE, but it's also DHS investigators. It's the FBI, CBP, DEA, right. ATF. Like, it's the IRS police. I saw something recently where someone was showing in Memphis just a whole gaggle of IRS police that were a part of the body snatching operation. The postal police, U.S. I've only met one U.S. postal police person in my life. And now it's like somehow they are now being put on the street, right? And just the fact that they have to move people from one, you know, to move the body snatchers from one city to another city shows that they don't right now have the numbers they need. That's why they're trying to get that $170 billion. But they certainly are throwing everything out there. And good to see that people are seeing the light, right? And that people are really understanding how horrible this situation is. If you had in the last minute one thing that you could say to folks about what you hope they would be doing right now to support immigrants, particularly those that are being detained by ICE, what would you say?
Vote. Go on and vote for your senators, your Democratic senators. We need to get them in the spaces. We need to win the primary, the preliminary, all of them, right? We need to go out and vote. Vote, 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 vote. We need to vote. That's what I'm going to say. We need to vote. We need to make sure that we have, Democrats have the majority. That's all I'm going to say.
Giving you the last word. Thank you so very much, Mildred. Really appreciate you coming on. Appreciate you. Have a wonderful rest of your day in spite of everything. Hug those babies.
Thank you so much. Have a good one. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you. That was Mildred Pierre, advocate, strategist, speaking about what is happening with her family, her fiance, Rodney Taylor, in detention prison, been there for almost exactly a year to the day, since January 15th of last year, letting us know why we all must jump in this fight against the body snatchers. That's our show, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and assistant producer, Gary Scott, and of course you for your continued support. Let's get together at the same time, same place, next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well as you can be.
Give a gift to KPFK and yourself when you let us take your unwanted vehicle off your hands. Not only will your donation help support the on-air programs our community relies on every day,